Hello, everybody, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. The articles I'm reading today were published by the Geographic Society in December of 2024. I hope you enjoy the program. We'll begin with this article, How a Poem Transformed Christmas into the Festive Holiday It Is Today. The famous words, "'Twas the night before Christmas," shaped the holiday by popularizing stockings, reindeer, and even Santa Claus. But the classic poem also sparked a centuries-long controversy. It's written by Aaron Blakemore. The American obsession with Santa Claus and the tradition of gift-giving merriment have a more complicated background than one might think. A peek at the December 23, 1823 issue of the Troy Sentinel offers a clue. On that day, readers could peruse ads for buffalo robes and local honey, or learn about the latest events in Congress. But those feeling the holiday spirit may have been drawn to the words, "'Twas the night before Christmas," on page 3. The poem was brief, just a few stanzas, and at the time anonymously authored. Originally titled, "'Account of a Visit from St. Nicholas," the poem told the tale of a father's encounter with a lively Santa Claus and his reindeer. Modern readers who know the poem better by its first line may see its account of Santa's sojourn to a house filled with sleepy children and carefully hung stockings as a comforting depiction of a traditional Christmas. But its lines, claimed by Clement Clark Moore, didn't just reflect Christmas. They shaped it. The poem would go on to change the face of the holiday in the United States and beyond. A Holiday Recipe. It is not clear how the unsigned poem made its way to the Troy Sentinel. Sent anonymously, it was just one of many poems in the paper that day. Its origins are contested, but Moore later claimed to have written it for his 9 children, and to have read it out loud on Christmas Eve, 1822. Though the verse's origins were murky, their appeal was clear to editors, who passed it on to other papers for republication, a common practice among 19th-century periodicals. It gives readers a perfect template of what a domestic Christmas should look like, says Thomas Royes Smith, a professor of American literature and culture at the University of East Anglia, who studies the history of Christmas in the United States. Far from tradition, Moore's poem contained all the elements for a different kind of Christmas, one that, though relatively new, seems as normal as Easter eggs and Halloween jack-o'-lanterns today. The poem spread, and readers besieged the Sentinel to ask who authored it. Only the publication of the New York Book of Poetry anthology 14 years later did an author, classics scholar Clement Clark Moore, step forward. By then, the poem had beguiled a generation of children and influenced the Christmas traditions of generations to come. Before the 1820s, Smith explains, Christmas would have been unrecognizable to modern readers. Observation of the holiday, when it was celebrated at all, varied widely from region to region, and usually involved street festivities and heavy drinking. Christmas isn't widely celebrated in America at that point, Smith tells history. When it is, it's a rowdy street celebration, drawing on old world traditions. These customs had become popular in Western Europe, then spread to the U.S., along with the first waves of immigrants to the new nation. Creating Christmas. The traditions reflected in Moore's poem could not be more different. Instead of adult revelry, Moore's Christmas involves sleeping children and a twinkling elf who sneaks into their homes at night to deliver gifts. Both toy-filled stockings and Santa himself are Dutch in origin, derived from the Netherlands' annual feast celebrating Sinterklaas, or St. Nicholas, on December 5th. The real St. Nicholas was a 4th-century bishop, not exactly the image of Christmas magic. The poem's depiction of a dimpled, fur-clad elf differs greatly from Dutch tradition. In Holland, Sinterklaas is tall, rail-thin, and long-bearded. According to the Dutch, the saint's traditional homeland is Spain, not the North Pole, and he has a controversial sidekick, Zwarte Piet, or Black Pete. Even today, some white revelers portray the figure, a dark-skinned demonic assistant often depicted in blackface. This court's contention about the Netherlands' colonial and racial legacies, sparking ongoing debates that pit tradition against modern social attitudes. Dutch New Yorkers recognize the holiday in their homes, but those without Dutch roots would only know about the tradition from fantastical stories like the likes of Moore's friend Washington Irving. Irving's 1809 story, A History of New York, a parody credited to a fictitious Dutch author, includes a dream in which a pipe-smoking St. Nicholas astonishes observers by flying through the sky in an enchanted wagon. Moore was not Dutch, but he was a New Yorker, and he borrowed prodigiously from Dutch traditions while writing the poem. He elaborated on customs and mixed in others, such as Santa's legendary reliance on reindeer to pull his sleigh, an idea taken from an 1821 poem, also anonymously published in New York. Moore went one step further, giving the reindeer names that originally included Donder and Blitzen, thunder and lightning in Dutch. Moore's poem arrived at a crucial moment, says Smith. It's right at the pivot point where Christmas becomes far more of a domestic celebration focused on the family, the home, and children. In early days of the United States, celebrating Christmas was controversial, especially to those who subscribed to the austere Calvinism of America's early white settlers. But changes were afoot by the early 1800s. As cities matured and industrialization beckoned, Americans began associating the holiday with the comforts of home. Assisted by growing mass media that gave the poem a wider audience, Christmas became a time for family and childlike wonder. That magic didn't include what some considered a critical part of Christmas, Christianity. The poem sidesteps religion, depicting a secular holiday that offers a happy Christmas to all. That contrasted with the opinions of many with the Calvinist view that Christmas be a solemn holiday, if celebrated at all. It also fueled an ongoing dispute about how religious Christmas should be, a debate that, Smith notes, still rages today. New traditions. If Moore's mix of Dutch tradition and magic including stockings, supernatural chimney descents, and flying reindeer was the recipe, Americans followed it to a T. The poem's popularity led families without Dutch roots to try hanging up their stockings and giving gifts, posing as a mysterious Saint Nick. Soon, Americans were adopting the traditions of other cultures, too, from decorating German Christmas trees to sending and receiving Christmas cards, a practice inaugurated by England's Queen Victoria in 1843. This was accelerated by retailers who encouraged Christmas consumption and even made up traditions of their own, such as Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, an invention of advertiser and department store scion Robert L. May. Along the way, a visit from St. Nicholas persisted. It has been set to music by artists like Louis Armstrong and Perry Como, recited in films from The Santa Claus to National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, and formed the basis of many parodies. Maybe its appeal lies in its sing-song rhymes, so easy for children and parents to memorize, or the idea of a rotund, mischievous Santa whose secretive work happens each Christmas Eve. Regardless, the poem is still one of the most widely read American poems of all time, and an appealing template onto which Americans can project their whims and worries about the meaning of the ever-evolving holiday. Perhaps its greatest gift is its whimsical, benevolent Santa Claus, described in the poem's original introduction as that homely but delightful personification of parental kindness. Even if a more influenced Santa Claus has long since passed your chimney by, there's no escaping the holiday he helped create, or the nearly universal appeal of a silent house. And that completes the article. The title was How a Poem Transformed Christmas into the Festive Holiday It Is Today, by Aaron Blakemore. And now over to the science section with this article, The Geminids Meteor Shower Peaks This Week. Here's What Causes Them. The best time to watch for shooting stars is during the peak of an annual meteor shower. Here's everything you need to know about these spectacular displays, by Victoria Jaggard. When you wish upon a falling star, you're actually offering your hopes and dreams to a small piece of space rock burning up as it plummets through Earth's atmosphere. Known as meteors, these brilliant streaks of light have entranced humans for centuries, especially when they arrive in bursts of blazing glory during sky shows called meteor showers. Scientists have long known since the mid-1800s that almost all meteor showers are born from icy comets. When one of these visitors from deep space enters the inner part of the solar system, heat from the sun causes ices on the comet's surface to change from ice to gas, a process called sublimation. This is what produces a comet's beautiful tail. As the ices vaporize, the comet releases dust, sand, grain-sized particles, and even a few boulder-sized chunks of stone that get left behind in its wake. With each orbit, that process creates a stream of debris along the comet's path that persists long after the dirty ice ball has headed back out to the edges of the solar system. In some cases, Earth crosses through the debris streams during its trip around the sun. As the planet plows through the cometary leftovers, rocky bits slam into our atmosphere and burn up, creating a spectacular display in the night sky. And we are not alone. Meteor showers also happen on Mars, although the red planet sees different displays based on the cometary paths it crosses. A small number of meteor showers buck the trend and originate from asteroids, not comets. The Geminids fall into this category and are thought to come from the asteroid 3200 Phaethon. Scientists aren't exactly sure how the space rock achieves such a dazzling display, but one study posits that the asteroid is part of a larger planetary body, possibly a comet, that broke up in a collision or explosion, and the resulting debris gives us the meteor shower. Outbursts and fireballs. A few meteors may fall on any given night, but the best time to watch for them is during the peak of an annual meteor shower. This is when Earth crosses through a particularly dense part of a comet's debris stream, an event that happens at predictable times each year. Seen from Earth's surface, the meteors in annual showers appear to radiate from particular points in the night sky. Most showers are therefore named after the constellation from which they seem to fall. For instance, the prolific Perseid meteor shower that happens every August is named for its origin in the area of the constellation Perseus, the mythical hero. Each major meteor shower has different peak rates at which its shooting stars fall. Some, like the Lyrids in April, see rates of about 15 to 20 meteors an hour. Others, like the Geminids in December, deliver as many as 60 to 70 meteors an hour. But these debris streams are not entirely uniform, and some normally weak showers are known for producing occasional outbursts of up to 1,000 meteors an hour, while others will punctuate the sky show with bright fireballs. The different annual showers also see meteors fall at different speeds, which can affect how long the streaks last in the sky. Unfortunately, astronomers can't predict when a given meteor shower will produce especially dazzling displays with much accuracy. And some of the major meteor showers are best seen from either the southern or northern hemisphere, depending on their associated constellation. To offer a more controlled experience, one company in Japan has proposed a way to create artificial meteor showers using satellites and specially designed meteors made of chemical-filled pellets. The best way to experience a natural meteor shower is to head into darker rural areas, away from light pollution, and wait for the shower's radiant constellation to rise high in the sky. Allow your eyes to adjust to the dark, and then watch out for the ephemeral bursts of light. And that's the end of the article. The title was "The Geminids Meteor Shower Peaks This Week. Here's What Causes Them," by Victoria Jaggard. The next article is titled 83 Years After Pearl Harbor, Here's How the Attack Changed History, by Aaron Blakemore. Masao Asada had just finished delivering groceries around Pearl Harbor, Oahu, when he heard some huge booms. No big deal, he thought. He was used to hearing noise from dredging activities in the Pacific Ocean Lagoon. But the booms kept coming. Asada jumped into his truck and drove toward the pier used by the U.S. Navy and Army. En route, he was flagged down by the driver of another car. "Get out of here," the man shouted, Asada recalled in an oral history taken years later. "This is not practice. It's war." That's when Asada looked to the sky and saw Japanese warplanes zooming overhead. The grocery store owner was one of thousands of eyewitnesses to Japan's surprise attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, an act of war that, though 90 minutes long, irrevocably changed the course of world history. The lead-up to the Pearl Harbor attack. Tensions between Japan and the U.S. simmered throughout the early 20th century and came to a boil in the 1930s as Japan attempted to conquer China, even attacking civilians. In 1937, China and Japan went to war. By 1940, the U.S. considered the Japanese expansion into China threatening enough to its interests that it began to provide military aid to China and started to sanction Japan. after Japan signed mutual defense pacts with Nazi Germany, Italy, and the Soviet Union in 1940 and 1941, the U.S. froze Japanese assets and forbade all exports into Japan. Meanwhile, Nazi Germany continued its conquest of much of Europe. Though the U.S. was officially neutral in both conflicts, its stance was increasingly challenged both by Japan and Nazi Germany's wars. Neutrality was the most divisive public issue of its day, and a majority of the American public, which remembered the losses of World War I and was still recovering from the effects of the Great Depression, opposed entering any war overseas. Still, many Americans wanted the nation to help its embattled allies. President Franklin D. Roosevelt accomplished this through the Lend-Lease program, which provided allies like Great Britain and China with weapons and military equipment. But as Japan continued its war with China, a conflict with the U.S. became all but inevitable, prompting Japanese leaders to assess their options. The U.S. Navy was formidable, and Japan didn't have the resources it needed to eliminate the American threat to their imperial ambitions. But they had one trick up their sleeve, surprise. Admiral Yamamoto Isoruko convinced Japan's military officials that instead of declaring war on the U.S., they should confront them in the Pacific, doing as much damage to the Pacific Fleet as possible. Planning the attack. While mainland U.S. forces mobilized in the wake of a surprise attack, Yamamoto argued Japan could seize strategic Pacific islands. Japan was desperate for supplies, and the islands that lay between Japan and the furthest U.S. territory in Hawaii could provide much-needed oil and rubber. Yamamoto spent months patiently planning the operation with Naval Captain Minoru Genda and others. In December 1941, Japan's monarch Hirohito finally bowed to months of pressure from the military and authorized war. Despite evidence that Japan was building up air forces, the attack took the U.S. by surprise. On December 6, 1941, Army intelligence officers even intercepted a message that indicated war was imminent. But the military had no idea Pearl Harbor was the target, and by the time the message was en route to a telegraph office in Honolulu, the attack had already begun. What happened December 7th? The first shot of the attack on Pearl Harbor was actually fired before dawn by the USS Ward, an American destroyer that had been alerted to an early morning submarine periscope sighting near the harbor entrance. The Ward sank the submarine. But since American forces did not expect an aerial assault, there was no general alarm. At 7:48 a.m. Hawaiian time, the first wave of Japanese dive bombers began flying over Pearl Harbor. Their targets were Navy-held Ford Island and seven nearby battleships, located along what was known as Battleship Row. Within minutes, much of the U.S. fleet had been damaged or destroyed. Over the course of two waves, a total of 353 Japanese planes and 28 submarines irreparably destroyed two battleships, Oklahoma and Arizona, and damaged all of the rest and several other fleet craft. The Japanese also targeted nearby airfields. Though caught by surprise, the Americans did fight back. They manned anti-aircraft guns and even got some airplanes off the ground. In all, 29 Japanese planes were shot down during the attack. The toll of Pearl Harbor. Ultimately, 2,400 Americans died. Nearly half of those deaths took place on the Arizona, which took a direct hit to its hull. 38 sets of brothers, including multiple sets of three brothers, served on the ship, and only one of those sets survived. Some civilians were killed by friendly fire, when anti-aircraft ammunition that did not detonate while being fired at Japanese aircraft fell. Only 64 Japanese servicemen were killed that day. The U.S. enters the war. The attack shocked the nation and thrust the U.S. into a war it had managed to sidestep for years. The day after the attack, President Roosevelt asked Congress for a declaration of war against Japan, calling December 7th a date which shall live in infamy. He told the U.S. Congress that the nation was in grave danger. Only one member of Congress, Representative Jeanette Rankin of Montana, voted against the declaration. Rankin, a pacifist and first woman in Congress, had also voted against the U.S. entering into World War I. On December the 11th, both Germany and Italy honored their pact with Japan and declared war against the U.S., which swiftly reciprocated. What followed would be a conflict that laid waste to most of Europe and Japan and that ended in 15 million battle deaths, 25 million wounded in battle, and at least 45 million civilian deaths. Ultimately, 416,800 American service members would die in the war. Pearl Harbor had other brutal legacies. The Japanese Military's Act was used to justify the internment of about 120,000 people of Japanese descent in the mainland U.S., including 70,000 U.S. citizens. And it forever ended the U.S.'s pre-1941 stance of isolationism and neutrality. And that ends the article. The title was 83 Years After Pearl Harbor, Here's How the Attack Changed History, by Aaron Blakemore. And that ends the broadcast. This has been the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds reader. I hope you enjoyed the program. The articles I've read were all published by the Geographic Society in December of 2024. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with its premium programming. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then click on Demand. You'll see a list of programs available to you. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.